House Committee on Judiciary come to order today is Wednesday, May 10th, 2017. And the first item on the agenda that we're going to today, it's not quite on the first one on the agenda, but it's Senate Bill 795A. Call Senator Montes Anderson and Representative Weininger, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 795A addresses sexual assault medical assessments. The bill requires the provider of a sexual assault medical assessment or a law enforcement officer to contact a victim advocate and make reasonable efforts to ensure that the advocate is available to the victim at the medical facility where the assessment is conducted. The bill also requires the advocate to clearly inform the victim that the victim may decline the services of the advocate and prohibits the advocate from impeding medical services or the investigation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview, and I'm delighted to be here to present to you Senate Bill 795. As you know, a sexual assault victim is in need of many services. Some want them and some don't. What Senate Bill 795 does is it actually strengthens the Oregon's personal representative law, which states that a victim may choose a personal representative to support them during the medical forensic exam. However, Oregon's law does not specifically require the medical professional or law enforcement to notify the victim of their right. Senate Bill 795 ensures a victim of sexual assault be able to discuss their option to have advocacy services in person so the victim can make an informed decision about their care. Just allowing an advocate to be present during an exam provides immediate support and presents the opportunity for victims to be informed of additional resources that are available to them to assist in their recovery, including the address confidentiality program, the counseling resources, safety planning, crime victims compensation, and follow-up services to provide ongoing support at the consent of the victim. And remember, all of this is voluntary. They do not need to have that. This is best practice. It is recommended in the National Protocol for Sexual Assault Medical Forensics Examinations. The victim advocate can offer crisis intervention and advocacy services to victims, their families, and their friends. Dispatching an advocate would not delay or compromise any emergency medical care needed. They can decline the services, as I said, and the medical personnel and or law enforcement should reference their local county sexual assault response team protocols to identify whether the advocacy program is the local community-based nonprofit, the district attorney victim assistant program advocate, or the tribal program advocate. Colleagues, I think this is a really important bill for sexual assault victims, and I would certainly hope that you'll be able to take it to the floor.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, I'm Ann Leininger, state rep for House District 38, Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland, and I'm honored to be here today in support of Senate Bill 795. I have talked to a lot of sexual assault survivors and people who advocate for sexual assault survivors, and I know that the process of going through evidence collection after an assault is one of the most traumatic times for a survivor, and I think by helping people have access to an advocate with them at that time, it'll make the path smoother and it'll help people make decisions about seeking justice, understanding their options, finding counseling that will ease the trauma that a person has experienced. So I strongly support the bill and I hope that you will give it your aye vote.
One other further comment. The Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force brought this bill forward, and I just want to thank Michelle Roland Schwartz for working so closely with my office and getting this put forward.
I just would say, I've just talked to a recently retired judge from Portland recently. She was talking about having been at the doctor's office and had been told there was an issue, cancer. She said at that point she didn't hear anything else that was being said. And I would think victims from these assaults of that night, everything's going to be more confusing than ever. If any of you go to a hospital unexpectedly, things are confusing. That would be very confusing, and where the advocate could help settle that down and explain things slowly as they're trained to do. I think this is a good bill. Thank you for your testimony.
Thanks.
Representative Springer, I'm sorry.
Freeze.
Freeze.
I'm sorry, I just said it that way.
Yeah.
Someone's trying.
Bang, bang. Yeah.
Guess you know what road I'm going down. And maybe it isn't even a question for you. When I first looked at this, I thought, no, why are we mandating something to the extent that we are here? And it made me reflect back. I've been in a fair amount of ER rooms with rape victims. And it made me think back. I'd never thought about it. Now I wish I knew some of those ladies and I could apologize for my behavior. Because I sat there, you're sitting there waiting for the rape kit, using the term while we're waiting for him to get the rape kit. I would hope that it's not done that way now. Trying to make small talk. Is there something you need? Can I get you something? They don't know what they need. They know nothing at that point and are unable to make decisions, not just hear a bad word and forget everything else, but not even able to articulate needs or concerns. And I remember offering, well, we can get somebody to come in and help you, and this was usually at 2 or 3 a.m. Do you want me to get someone? No. I don't know. And part of that is insensitivity of that time, and disconnect of the situation. But there really needs to be that person that is not only more compassionate, but knows how to ask the questions or encourage things, other than I'm going to be on overtime here shortly, and that's can we right. move things along? I wish I knew who some of those women were, because I'm sure I wasn't nearly as nice as I needed to be. So I think I'm a big fan now, frankly.
Thank you, Representative Springer. And you're right. These women go through, they all react differently, but it is some have ongoing post-traumatic stress, and they stay in shock for a while. And so it really is nice to have someone that can be there for them, even though they may not know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'll call. We have more people. Okay. Thank you. Michelle Roland-Schwartz, B.B. Beltran, and Ashley Bately. Hi, please go ahead in the order. Just remember to identify yourself for the record.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson and Olson. For the record, my name is Michelle Roland Schwartz. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, and I'm really pleased to be here today in support of Senate Bill 795. I appreciate the advocacy on behalf of Senator Mona Sanderson and Representative Leininger, and appreciate the remarks that have already been made about this bill. This is a bill that the task force really believes and understands the dynamics of what's happening in the hospital when someone presents for medical forensic care. So this would require that a victim advocate be called out and give victims the opportunity to talk about what advocacy is and their options so that they really can make an informed decision about their care. I think that this bill also asks us to think beyond the sexual assault evidence kit, or sometimes referred to as the rape kit, by thinking about this as an opportunity to provide not only comprehensive medical care, but wraparound advocacy services, and it eases that transition from the hospital to ongoing advocacy services so that victims really have information about what is available to them so that they're not navigating the legal health care systems and other social service systems on their own, and then later present to a program like BB or Ashley's with very complex and compounded situations that then they're working on later. And so if we can get that upfront advocacy, I really believe this mitigates some of that long-term impact on victims. And so for that reason, I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Ashley Beatty, and I'm the program coordinator for the Deschutes County District Attorney's Office Victims Assistance Program. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 795, namely because our sexual assault response team did exactly this. We identified that it is our goal to provide in-person advocacy to every single victim survivor who presents to the hospital and is looking for a sexual assault forensic exam kit, so a formerly rape kit. And we believe it's their right to know what their choices are, to have advocacy present. What we do as an advocate present, and it is ourselves and the nonprofits that respond based on what our sexual assault response team has determined is appropriate, we really reinforce what a victim's rights are. We explain the process in a way that's easily understood. It sounds like you guys have already identified that when someone's in trauma, they have a hard time comprehending some of the complex things that go on. And we allow the victim survivor to make an educated decision for her health, her safety, and her recovery. And if I could just rewind a little bit, some of what we see when victim survivors do not get advocacy up front, and Michelle touched on it a little bit, is when we see something like the Stanford sexual assault case go national, and we get all this media coverage, it's on CNN, it's on the Today Show, then our programs start getting calls from survivors who are now ready to be strong and report. But unfortunately, what happens is that some of the times they didn't know their rights in the beginning. And so now we're getting what's a really complex, compounded issue. And sometimes they've missed their opportunity to prosecute because they didn't know their rights up front. And I really believe that Senate Bill 795 would help fix this. So thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Bibi Beltran, and I am the Executive Director of Sexual Assault Support Services, SAS. SAS is a nonprofit organization providing outreach, advocacy, and support to survivors of sexual violence and their partners, families, and friends throughout Lane County. SAS advocates listen, believe, support, accompany, offer information and referrals, and provide peer counseling to survivors of sexual violence, past or present. We maintain a 24-hour crisis and support line and provide 24-hour emergency advocacy for survivors of sexual assault and sexual abuse. So in essence, we're the ones who are responding to the hospital when there's a call out. As was brought up earlier, in the immediate aftermath of a traumatic event, survivors often experience many complex emotions, including fear, grief, sadness, anger, and confusion. Navigating complicated systems is a challenge for many, but for trauma survivors, it can be extremely overwhelming. Advocates play a crucial role in empowering survivors by informing them of their options, rights, and resources, including the Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Fund, which not only covers the cost of a medical assessment and evidence collection, but also provides counseling, the Address Confidentiality Program, and Crime Victims Compensation, to name just a few. Without advocates, many survivors would be unaware of available services and resources and may not access the support they need and deserve. Sort of like what Ashley is saying, it's easier for us to help identify what the survivor wants if we're there in the beginning. Senate Bill 795 would ensure survivors of sexual violence are fully informed about services, resources, processes, and outcomes by having access to an advocate in the acute immediate aftermath of an assault. SAS advocates work from an empowerment-based approach and provide information and options rather than advice. We believe survivors are in the best position to determine what is right for their situation. Senate Bill 795 is in alignment with this philosophy of empowering survivors by providing them with accurate information and supporting their autonomy. To that end, a key component of Senate Bill 795, which ensures survivors are in the driver's seat, is that they may decline advocacy services at any time. The impact of sexual violence and trauma are far-reaching and may involve many complex systems. Oregon has been a leader in creating survivor-centered legislation and improving our system's responses to sexual violence. And Senate Bill 795 would continue that trend. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Stark, sorry.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Actually, just more of a comment. I really like that we're looking at taking this from a may contact to a shall contact. Mm-hmm. And I think that changes the scenario for everyone. It changes for the provider when they look at this or a scenario, they no longer carry the weight of should I or should I not in this scenario. It changes for the person receiving services when they're wondering, oh, why did you just call someone? What's going on? Am I in trouble now? Instead of saying our normal procedure is that this person comes in. It really changes the scenario for all things better.
Absolutely.
Good grammar there. Anyway, you guys get it. So I'm excited about this bill. Thank you for advocating for it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's call Aaron Knott and Lucinda Heights Claybaugh. Yeah.
Go ahead. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice here in support of Senate Bill 795. The Department of Justice houses the Crime Victim Services Division, which is the reflection of a long-term and targeted investment by this body in providing the best services to victims that we can. And I think we do have a system we can be proud of. We have resources available to compensate victims for their losses, to provide counseling, to refer all sorts of treatment. But this system is only as good and as useful as its ability to actually connect with the victims of crime. And that's why we're here in support of Senate Bill 795. This is a crucial opportunity to help connect crime victims with services at the moment that they need them the most. And it's important to remember that for a wide range of reasons, many of these cases will never make it to that next step. That's the nature of this beast. There may not be an indictment. There may not be a prosecutable case. That does not mean there is not a victim who needs services. And so this really does the job it needs to do of making sure that we make the connection at the time that we need to connect, which is as early in the process as possible, with a competent professional relaying that these services exist. I'm also pleased to relay to this committee the support of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Chiefs of Police, all of whom asked me to put their support on the record.
Thank you. Okay, please go ahead, Lucinda.
My name is Lucinda Heights Claybaugh. I live in Forest Grove, and I come to you today, I can say, as a rape victim when I was younger, but I come to you mostly now asking for you to seek some balance and fairness, because I have been working as a volunteer advocate for the Innocence Project on cases where people were falsely accused of crimes and then were wrongfully convicted and wrongfully suffered incarceration. And a lot of it went back to a lack of fair process in the very beginning, lack of fair and unbiased investigation. And I would like to ask you to consider a couple of points here regarding this bill, why I think it is not a good bill as it stands, why it could be made much better, and why it must be made much better to be fair. And I would like to mention that Christopher Perry, who is the director of the Center for Prosecutor Integrity, which is out of Virginia, Washington, D.C., spoke about the need for justice-centered methods, recommending that investigators disregard preconceived inclinations, forget about presumed guilt, seek out all relevant evidence, and produce unbiased reports. The respectful treatment of complainants is not incompatible with the pursuit of impartial, accurate, and honest investigation. But we stand at a crossroads now where we've had a pendulum swing to victim-centered investigation, which are inconsistent with the very basic notions we have in our Constitution and our Bill of Rights about fairness and justice. And we would ask you as lawmakers to bring about an end to such practices. We just celebrated Wrongful Conviction Day. Victim-centered methods abandon traditional notions of impartiality and objectivity. They instead call upon investigators to presume that all sexual assault cases are valid unless established otherwise. Such recommendations represent a negation of a long-held tenet of a presumption of innocence that we have in our country. and they are likely to lead to wrongful convictions. To give you an example of how many we're talking about, Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld in March at our Innocence Project networking conference in San Diego said that it was over 90% of the men who had just been exonerated for sexual crimes they had not committed. And it had all gone back to the beginning processes of how the investigations had been performed. To have some understanding of why this is a concern, I'm presenting to you the Oregon Medical Guidelines for Evaluation of Sexual Abuse in Children and Adolescents, which does come from the Department of Justice. And what you're doing here is in conflict with and violates state protocols and Oregon state interviewing guidelines that have best practices. How you do something, how you connect somebody in that process makes all the difference in the world between an innocent person having a presumption of guilt so that the victim, the alleged victim survivor, is contaminated. That evidence of them giving their first all-important statement, that all-important first interview. And as some of you are former law enforcement, you know what I'm talking about. That all-important first interview can have somebody asking leading questions, which set the whole atmosphere, that set the whole direction of the rest of a presumption of guilt. And then an innocent person coming in won't be able to have that fair opportunity for a first clean, unbiased interview tape. So, for children, I guess my first question is, what is the age of the alleged victim survivor in this? It's not clear in this legislation. I think that needs to be made clearer, because if you are talking about a school investigation, we have very clear protocols that were supposed to be being followed for years and have not been. And as a result, there are people who are being wrongfully convicted. Everybody's supposed to call CARES Northwest, whether you're DHS, whether you're law enforcement, whether you're the school district. The designated people on that MDT team are supposed to call CARES Northwest and get a highly qualified medical assessment specialist, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a psychiatric nurse practitioner, a psychiatric nurse, a person who is highly qualified with very specific forensic investigational assessment training, as well as the medical training. And the important piece is it has to be fully video recorded. You turn on the tape. You don't turn off the tape until it's all done in the extended evaluation with all the open-ended questions, unbiased, not presuming guilt. All the careful questions have been asked to discern whether or not there actually even was a sexual assault or a crime committed. And you cannot presume guilt in that process. If you put yourself in your shoes, if you were falsely accused of a crime, what fair process and constitutional rights would you want for yourself? You'd want it to be fair. You'd certainly want an opportunity to have a preliminary hearing, not having grand juries hiding things so that you can't even know what's going on, because you don't know. You are innocent. This all presumes guilt. A lot of this is presuming guilt. And so my first question is, what is the age of this alleged victim survivor supposed to be? That should be clarified. And why isn't everybody just calling CARES Northwest for this proper extended evaluation, which is fully taped? If you don't fully tape it, if you do have law enforcement with guns and uniforms, then you have a power authority dynamic which taints that interview. People at Liberty House, when they get called here in Salem, they're supposed to go to Liberty House. Liberty House has two-way mirrors. the men with guns and the uniforms and the influence and the authority power dynamic are behind those mirrors. They're not being seen. And in the same way, I believe that the advocate who comes in needs to be able to simply say, I am here, and I'll be in the other room, and when this is over, I'll be right here. I'll be right here. But that's it. They are not to be there where the kid is looking at them to be influenced by their facial expressions and their body language and everything else that plays into how something is biased and would taint the evidence. You want good evidence. I want good evidence. Everybody wants the common good of what is really going on, what happened, what evidence will prove that something has happened. So this person must go behind that two-way mirror. And in the same way that children and adolescents are supposed to go through a fair process, I believe that we need to have all people. When I was a rape victim, I think that would have been an appropriate thing. There would have been able to have been a better investigation. I think that I could have then gotten my hugs, my support, my crying, all the things I needed to go through. I definitely was traumatized for a long time. But I know that in order to have a clean investigation, a fair investigation for everybody, that the truth has to be found, and all the details, the whole truth and nothing but the truth has to be found, and all of that information has to be available and on tape. No Watergate gaps in that tape. You know that you started it, you know you stopped it. All of it's there for a good investigation. And if you have somebody that has actually done something, you've got it on tape. But it also then would provide a fair opportunity for an innocent person to come in and get that information and have that as evidence. It should be fully disclosed. No grand jury hearings where you can't get it and where people don't get it to you until you're going to trial, because that presumes guilt. You can't be presuming guilt at any part of this process. That's what our Constitution has told us. So I would ask that how you go about this process makes all the difference in the world. We want a bill, but we want a good bill. And I'm sorry, but this just isn't it. We can do better. We have to do better. We must do better for the innocent person that's being falsely accused. And you'll have people going to prison wrongfully because they didn't have the whole process. Instead of sending people when they walk in the door to a hospital, they should be going to a CARES Northwest Center, a Liberty House too. Every woman needs that kind of support. That's what we should be doing instead of having people going to police departments and hospitals. They should be going directly to a CARES Northwest trained, qualified person who will be able to have that proper assessment process. One that will do the job, that will find the truth, seek out all the truth, and let people get the help they need, whoever they are, all parties, get the help they need. And that is our goal as a society, not to be making more people going into prison wrongfully. And I'm afraid that's what this would do. It would taint evidence. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Any questions?
I'd be able to answer any questions you might have about the protocols.
Are we about to work this? Okay, I'll
talk. Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 241A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 241A to the floor.
So we're on 795.
795.
Oh, 795. I'm sorry. Wrong numbers here.
We were just going to pass it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, 795.
All right.
Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 795A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 795A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Remsen moves Senate Bill 795A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Just a couple notes of clarification. You know, the bill itself does reference two Oregon statutes about how we are, you know, ORS 147.401 and 418.747, both dealing with the current protocols and procedures. So it can't be in conflict with those because it's supposed to be designed around those. And then I also want to remind this body overall that in 2015 we passed House Bill 3476 that laid out these victim advocates, 40 hours of training, and some of the concerns that are very legitimate concerns about how you could bias a situation. But we laid out in that, you know, bill that we passed and has been implemented, how we want to make sure these advocates are trained so as to not do that yet provide the support we want. And so I understand the concerns that were expressed, but I think we've really kind of set a good path forward on this.
Okay, thank you. Okay. We have a motion. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And Representative Leininger, you can read the bill first, please. Okay, open a, now we'll go to 241.
Okay.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 241. And we are not going to be having the work session on Senate Bill 34. We're setting that one over. If anybody, I apologize if anybody's waiting for that one.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 241A creates the Bill of Rights of Children of Incarcerated Parents. Thank you.
Okay, first call, Katty Grenow, Liz Craig, and Jessica Katz. Can you go in any order? Just remember to state your name for the record, please.
Okay. I will go first.
Okay.
Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Williamson and Olson, my name is Kylie Grunow, and I'm here today on behalf of the YWCA of Greater Portland. We are incredibly pleased to be able to offer testimony in support of Senate Bill 241A, which creates the Bill of Rights for Children of Incarcerated Parents.
Thank you.
Very pleased to be here. I have several people behind me who have testimony that is far more important than mine, so I'm going to be very brief and to share with you a few key points about the bill. First, the original version of this bill created a task force, and it was very quickly becoming very unwieldy and costly. And so through the leadership of the governor's office, the Department of Corrections, and also Senator Dembro's office, we were able to identify the Governor's Reentry Council as an existing body that already had several of the departments and the agencies and the organizations that we had identified as needing to be on that task force who are already part of that council. So we appreciate the fact that they helped us identify that body. And so we worked with the Department of Corrections, and I think Liz is going to speak a little bit to the fact that they are willing and able to take on that work. I also wanted to point out that within the council, there are subgroups that have different focuses. And the Family and Community Engagement Implementation Team would be the one that would take on the work of the Bill of Rights for Children of Incarcerated Parents. And those different implementation teams aren't just made up of council members. They also include other organizations, representatives, and advocates so that we can really make sure that the people who need to be at the table having these discussions and thinking about the Bill of Rights can be there. So we very much appreciate that structure and look forward to working with the Department of Corrections on that piece. And finally, we're also working with Chair Barker on an amendment to really help clarify the intent. The bill did pass out of the Senate unanimously, but there is wide agreement by all the proponents of this bill about what we mean to be used by the Bill of Rights. This is not meant to be a series of mandates about what has to happen, but it's really about guiding principles about the considerations that need to be had as policy and procedure decisions are being made. There are lots of considerations, and we know that, about the things that need to happen and be taken into consideration. One of those needs to be about what the impact is on children of incarcerated parents. So that is really the intent here, that they are part of what we think about as we think about things in the criminal justice and public safety systems. So those are my quick 3 points, and then I will let Liz take over.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Craig. I'm with the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I want to provide just a little bit of context and background to this conversation. So going back to 2001, the legislature approved Senate Bill 133, which put into law the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project Work Group. And DOC played a significant role in that work group and implemented many of its recommendations, including family-oriented visiting spaces, the use of technology to enhance connectivity, and the establishment of parenting inside-out classes. And around that same time, we actually adopted our business model, which still exists today, the Oregon Accountability Model. And one of the components of that model is children and families, recognizing that connections to families and children while incarcerated are very important and crucial to individual success. As many of you know, when our director came on in 2012, one of her biggest initiatives was to increase even further that connectivity with children and families. And so, and this is because at the time, there was a research study that came out of the Minnesota Department of Corrections that found that the single most overriding factor in whether someone recidivated was whether or not that person received visits. And so we have worked to increase and expand visiting and family connections through a number of efforts. As you may know, Director Peters also chairs the Governor's Reentry Council. And as Kylie mentioned, in 2014, the council changed its structure somewhat and created seven implementation teams, each one with a specific focus on reentry, one of which is the Family and Community Connections Team. And so we are committed to working on the Bill of Rights of the Children of Incarcerated Parents through that implementation team, of which one of our assistant directors and a colleague at DHS chairs. So we've committed to that work through the Governor's Reentry Council. We also want to point out that the Bill of Rights will serve as a set of guiding principles rather than mandates, and we look forward to working on policies and procedures through the Reentry Council, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Barker and committee members, good afternoon. My name is Jessica Katz. I'm the director of the Family Preservation Project for the YWCA of Greater Portland and have worked with children and families impacted by our justice system for over 16 years. I'm a social worker and have a background in law as my professional training. And over the decade and a half or so that I have worked with families who are involved in the justice system, I've witnessed collected a lot of stories and just witnessed over and over again the collateral consequences to the children who did nothing wrong in the scenario. To date, we've worked on a couple of documentary films to bring some of these stories to life as we strive to work towards more sane solutions that both address public safety and also safeguard children. And recognizing that parents are indeed the first line of defense in protecting the well-being of their children, sometimes that line of defense fails. Sometimes those parents were not provided the safeguards that they needed in their own childhoods, and we see cycles of criminal justice involvement within families repeat and repeat. In our latest film project, which is still in process, we sought to elevate the voices of children specifically and to really spend some time asking them what they needed upon reflection. These are kids whose parents had been through the system and have now been back home. They are sort of through the traumatic period and upon reflection now had some time to look back and say, if the system were working perfectly, what would have looked different? We were curious to know from them what they would say. We have a short clip of that film today that doesn't get to the meat of that question quite yet, but that's coming and we will send you out a very excited notice that when we have our first screening. So we're hoping to move our collective, as Liz had mentioned, I was a part of that original work group back in 2003, I believe, and to move all of that collective wisdom, practice, knowledge forward into the policy arena with the passage of Senate Bill 241. We're hoping through this process to be able to provide children the things that they have identified that they need that we really now know over the course of many, many years of practice. And to finally really break a cycle that I believe we can have a strong impact on. So thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to answer questions as well.
Are there any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, panel. And call Senator Dembro, please.
Is it okay if I stay up here to start the video when you're...
Sure.
Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Sorry I was late. I'm Michael Dembro. I represent Senate District 23, that's Northeast, Southeast Portland, very pleased to bring you this bill. You may say, well, I look at the bill and it says it's coming from Human Services and Early Childhood, but it actually came out of the Task Force on Reentry in Housing and Employment that I was on with Senator Winters and Representatives Parrish and Frederick at the time. And, you know, one of the insights that we gained from looking at reentry and what makes successful reentry was the realization that reentry actually begins while the individual is inside. And, you know, the roots of successful reentry are born there. And a lot of it, as you heard from one of the people giving testimony, has to do with the extent of the solidity of the family bond. So if the family bond is maintained while the individual is inside and there's an opportunity to continue that bond after release, success tends to happen. And so it's something that we should further. And this Bill of Rights for the Children of Incarcerated Parents really came out of that. And I'm really proud to bring it to you. It reflects, I think, the need for us to be considering the situation of these children. It also gives us a vision for how we want to operate as a state with respect to these children and their parents, and a plan for how we're going to address it. And as I think you heard, the vehicle will be the Governor's Reentry Council, which will make recommendations to the different agencies that touch the lives of these children. If appropriate, make some budgetary requests to the agencies as the governor's recommended budget is being developed. So that's what it's about. I think there's a lot of excitement around this bill because most people, when they hear about it, it just makes sense to them that these kids have done nothing wrong themselves, and yet they end up often paying the price for activities that are done by other people, and they're so much in jeopardy for themselves entering going down a bad path in life. And so if we can prevent that from happening, we will avoid a lot of problems down the road. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Okay, thank you, Senator. Were you going to show
the? Yes, I'll show the clip. And I don't. I was also in charge of playing this clip at a breakfast we recently had, and things did not go as planned. So you saw the fear that went into my heart as I looked over when she was setting it up at the beginning of my comment. So I'm sorry that I froze there for a second. I was like, oh no, not the technology. Okay, let's see if I can get this to the right. Well, that's close enough.
There's a lot of rebuilding when someone gets out of jail. To be back, the rebuilding was like, she came out of jail, our mom, because of me. So it was cool.
Yeah, she was able to come see me before in the sterile visiting room, and that's amazing in itself, you know, just getting to see her. But the difference, you know, I think the emotional differences is what's really big. Her being able to talk about her emotions, you know, feeling safe at a place where, you know, it's okay, she can throw a tantrum and we're all moms and we're supportive, or, you know, we can talk about how she's mad or upset and things like that. Like, just her being able to talk about how she's feeling and what she was going through was huge.
We got to do, like, crafts, and we got to play, like, there were blocks that we could play with, and it was really fun. And then there were our little cubbies, and she made me a dream catcher. And I got to take that home, still hung on my ceiling.
You know, it's all about the next generation and these kids.
My goal is to join the military when I turn 18, and I just feel like there's a lot of people that I can help. This is something I'm good at.
I was thinking of, like, for the future? Yeah, I was thinking of going into something in the energy field.
A volleyball player or an artist. I want to be someone who can help animals.
I want to work with pets a lot.
A veterinarian. A zoo person, an aquarium. I don't care, I just want to help animals.
I want to be a doctor. The surgery.
I would like to be like a professional dancer, or like I would like to be a teacher or a doctor.
I'm going to meet this with my mom wants to work at this children's school for people that had disabilities.
I want to be a cop.
It just looks so cool to be a cop, to help people.
I just like, I want to help someone.
Because I want to help people.
Thank you. Next we'll call Ashley Doherty, Kessa Hulse, and Serenity Walker.
All right, good afternoon, committee members. My name is Ashley Doherty. I have a daughter that you saw in there. Her name is Sophia. She is now 8 years old. I was a participant in the FEP intensive program, and I've been out of prison about 2.5 years now. In 2011, I was involved in a drunk driving accident, and I got sentenced to 60 months at Coffee Creek. And I took that time to better myself and do amazing things, and I also took accountability for my actions. But my child has the right to a lifelong relationship with me despite my incarceration. But instead, what happened was it was a nightmare. She was 2.5, and from the moment of my arrest, we were helpless to know what to do with our futures. I needed other adults and the system to help me do what I didn't know how to do, which was there was a lot of DHS involvement. And my daughter was 2.5 and got taken out of where she knew from all of her family and placed with people that she didn't know, which was very traumatic for her. For 9 months, we got one visit because of disconnects between the system, and I feel like that was very traumatic for her and detrimental. DHS didn't want me to have my rights anymore. I fought for myself, I fought for my rights because of FPP, but not everyone had that opportunity. I saw many people go through situations where not only did they not know their rights or know how to exercise them, but their children didn't have the rights, and the children, they didn't commit the crime, but they're doing time as well. So I'm here just to, I'm committed to doing whatever I can to help other moms and kids to not have to go through the same things, so those kids have rights, so they don't end up going through the cycle like we did. So today I am going to school full-time, working, and me and my daughter have a great relationship, and I still have my rights, and I'm just here to strongly urge you guys to please support this and pass Senate Bill 241. Thank you.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Christina Hulse. I have two daughters, Serenity, who's 11, who's here with me, and Cedrice, who's 15. I was a participant in FPP's Family Resource Center. I've been out of prison for almost 2 years. I went to prison for a UUMV. I originally was sentenced to 32 months, and then while I was there, I got 39 months for the same crime for crossing county lines. There was, at the time that I was at prison, I wasn't a part of FPP, and I didn't know how to figure out what was going on with that, what was going on with my children. Over the first year that I was incarcerated, my mom got full custody of both my daughters. And so to continue communication with them, I just followed whatever she said for me to do. Unfortunately, there was no guide for her to go by or for me to go by, and so we didn't talk about what prison was or why I was there. My kids suffered due to a misinterpretation of my custody paperwork. I lived in Washington beforehand, and they didn't understand, and so I did not get to visit my kids for over 3 years. It took FPP as well as another program, and it took about a week's worth of time with these two programs working together, and I was then able to visit my kids. I have to look at the notes, I'm sorry. through FPP and working through visitations, because after 3 years, my kids were completely different. I didn't know what to do, the awkwardness, but they walked me through it, and I started building a relationship with both my daughters again, understanding where I was at and what they were going through helped tremendously with building that relationship. Since leaving prison, I have gained custody back of both of my daughters. I've adopted them back. I did that through FPP researching. I did all the legal paperwork myself, went to the court, took the bus, did everything, and got custody of them back. I now own a successful construction company and am in the process of franchising Dutch Brothers. And I hope to buy a house this summer. I'm here to strongly urge this committee to pass Senate Bill 241.
Hi, community. My name is Sterling Walker. I just turned 4 when my mom went away. I didn't know what happened to my mom. One day she was there, the next she was gone. I didn't get to visit my mom for 3 years. I always thought I did something wrong, and that's why I couldn't see my mom. I needed my mom even if she was in prison. I needed a grown-up to tell me my mom loved me because she wasn't allowed to. After a while, I started getting really angry at my mom because I couldn't see her. What I needed grown-ups to do was to help me understand what was happening. Nobody asked me what I wanted or how I felt. I needed a grown-up to listen to me. People need to understand that even when parents messes up, their kids still love and forgive them. And we are not going to forget about them. My mom is a good person who made a bad decision. Today I understand what happened because my mom has answered my questions today. I got to see my mom and I want other kids to be able to see their moms too. Kids need their moms even if their moms have to go away. Please make sure other kids have the right to a lifelong relationships with their parents if this is what the kids want. Other kids who have a parent go away should be able to have their questions answered. When things are happening, not have to wait for years to get the questions answered. I'm here because I want to make it better for other kids. And my sister, Satrice Walker, said, put yourself in our shoes. Thank you. Please pass SB 241.
Thank you very much.
Good job.
Great job. Okay, thank you, Pamela. And then next, Nova Sweet, Heather Rowlett, and Lucinda Heights-Claybaugh.
I'm Lucinda Heights-Claybaugh, and I am now before you as a person who lived at Coffee Creek for 756 days as an inmate before I was found to actually be innocent. And while I was there, I made a lot of friends with a lot of women who were missing their children terribly. You can't help but put women in a warehouse without human dignity being offered to them, without kindness or considerations being offered to them, and then expect everything to be okay. Those women and their children needed to be able to have contact, physical contact, which is not allowed in prison. And the kids suffer for it. The moms suffer too. But the kids really suffer. We need to rethink how we do punishment or our vengeance is meted out in our society. We need to think about what our goals at the end in the long term are. Are we seeking a beloved community where everyone is working towards healing and getting the help that they need? Getting the services they need, the programs certainly are not being provided in the prisons, not the way they need to be. I could testify for many hours to your committees on that. I got to be a fly on the wall, so I could tell you a lot. But I want this bill to go through. It's important for it to go through. It's a step in the right direction. Children and kids without their parents will suffer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, committee members. My name's Nova Sweet. I have two children, my son Marco, who's 17, and my daughter Malik, who is 10. They were both in the video. My son was, well, he's the one who began, and then my daughter was the one who wanted to be like me when she grows up. More on that in a minute. So I participated in the FPP intensive program, and I've been out of prison for, I guess, about as long as Ashley, 2.5 years or so. I made a series of really bad choices in 2010, and so in 2011, after been given multiple shots, I got the opportunity, and that's truly how I look at it, to go to Coffee Creek and change my life. The minimal programming that does happen for certain women, I got to be a part of because I advocated my butt off for it, because I knew I didn't want to keep making crappy choices with my life, and I knew I wanted to get home and take care of my kids. I'm grateful for that time. I wouldn't change it. I really wouldn't. My children, while I was gone, they had the right not to be blamed or judged or criticized for my decisions. Instead, what happened is my son really struggled. He was going into middle school. I missed his fifth grade graduation, and he got to do all his middle school years without me. He acted out. He was got multiple detentions, and I think he was suspended about 5 times. He has testified on the Senate side on behalf of this bill, and what he said, he's not here today because he had to take a test, otherwise he would have been. What he said was that even though he had family support, that having to go to school every day and deal with people who knew what happened was really hard. He said he needed help dealing with his anger and confusion, and he felt like others wanted to make him feel bad about what I had done. My son needed the adults at his school to know his situation and help him deal with it, rather than him feel ashamed about it. What I learned from my son's testimony is that even though he hadn't done anything wrong, he had a sense of being looked down upon. Whether or not it's reality, that was his perception, because I'm sure teachers were doing the best they could with what they had. I mean, me committing a crime is hard for anybody to talk about because there's lots of guilt and shame and questions around that. And so nobody really knows what to deal with that, how to say something. I believe had professionals included my child earlier in on discussions about what he was going through, that he would have definitely responded positively and been part of the solution rather than a huge pain in the butt through the middle school years. I just got a text from him. He's a big D1 recruit, and he picked up a UCLA offer 2 weeks ago, and he just picked up a Utah offer today. He's going D1, and I didn't screw up his life, thank God. Real quick story that I'll end with. About a week ago, my daughter had a friend over, and they wanted to do a performance. She's very into performances, and so I was sitting there as the only audience member, and the little girl was sitting in a chair looking at an iPod, and then this is the friend, and she says, "Oh, I got this iPod for Christmas. This is so great." And then my daughter walks out, and she has a coffee mug, and she's drinking out of it, and it says YWCA on it. And then she has this pink bag back here that I made that says I stand with FPP, and she goes, "Honey, I have to go to Portland to save FPP. I'll be back later, okay?" And I'm like, okay. And so that was the end of the skit, right? So fabulous. So then it dawns on me, oh my God, she's acting like me. She's mimicking my behavior. And like the deeper root of this is that I haven't completely effed up this child. She's not smoking cigarettes or talking about gangster talk or all this crazy stuff. She's actually like wanting to change the world, and she's proud of me. And I feel like we did the best we could, and we had some really supportive people through the prison, through the FPP, through the visiting room and whatnot. But there's another layer of support that we need for professionals to be able to reach out and help these kids. And I truly stand with the whole Senate Bill 241, and I hope that you guys do too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, committee members. My name is Heather Rowlett. I am the Family Preservation Project Coordinator. I have my master's degree in social work, and prior to this position, I was a family and crisis therapist in the community, a Multnomah County transition age youth clinician, a coach and trainer at the Regional Research Institute for Human Services, a foster parent, and I myself aged out of foster care and am the child of a formerly incarcerated parent. I was drawn to this work because I do not only personally understand the importance of supporting parents and their families during incarceration, but because I've seen the benefit that supports can have in communities that are under-resourced. When I review Senate Bill 241, I consider these human rights. The growth of the children of Oregon into the leaders and sustainers of tomorrow is a pivotal issue. Seems kind of nonsensical, right? The mental and physical health of every child should be a paramount concern, and when necessary, we should come together to best support their development with careful measures of meeting their needs, addressing their concerns and fears, and providing what we know and has been proven to edify the human condition. Every day with the mothers at Coffee Creek, I tell them that I am not special, that I did nothing they too could not have done with the assistance that I was given, but instead that it was sheer luck. That I was fortunate to be supported by professionals, coaches, and mentors throughout my early life who provided the resources and guidance that I was not receiving at home. Because of this, my goal has always been that no matter how far I go or what success I find, I will never forget where I came from. And that this is important to me solely because I know that if we were to properly invest resources into all children, other kids like me would have had a chance. I'm here today because I believe in Oregon. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and I love this state with every fiber of my being. And considering that we are already a leader on the forefront of social issues and equitable legislation, I'm excited to see what is to come as we continue to strive together to improve the lives in our communities. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much, and thank you for your testimony. And it's important, and it's been very great to hear some of the stories today.
Watch the newspaper.
Okay. So we're waiting on an amendment, so we will close the public hearing. We won't be ready today, correct?
No.
Yeah, okay. On that bill, we expect to move the bill as soon as we get the amendment in and get it in the paperwork. Anything further to come before the committee today? Thank you, committee. We stand adjourned. Thank you, committee. We stand adjourned. Before the committee today.